B-Pod Studios.
You know, the U.S. Open, I mean, it's sort of like golf's version of a porcupine, you know? I mean, it's going to stick you at some point, and you just have to understand that and move on from it.
Stay with us, and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of Neogenyx Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies, where all you have to lose is pain, and Greater Golf Express, the golfer's paradise. And now, here's your host, a man who knows that 50-foot putts roll in easier when you're already lying eight, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Neogenyx Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies, where all you have to lose is pain, and Greater Golf Express, the golfer's paradise, where you can get prior generation Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls for $39.99 a dozen, greatergolfexpress.com or Centrum Plaza Pineville. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. Well, it's U.S. Open week, golf's hardest test, and this year it will be contested on the cliffs of La Jolla, California at Torrey Pines, site of Tiger Woods' historic U.S. Open win on a broken leg, I might add, in 2008. There's lots to talk about, and we'll cover it several ways. First, a couple of weeks ago, we introduced you to Matt Sharpstein of the Charlotte 49ers, who, along with his dad on the bag, was medalist at a U.S. Open sectional qualifier in Dallas. His college coach, Ryan Cabbage, is out there with Team Sharpstein. And we'll pick his brain about Matt and what he's seeing out there. Then Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer will take us through all the major storylines this week. And to close out the show, I want to remember that it's Father's Day weekend. And as such, want to give you a golf something to gift the old man. When I think of the U.S. Open, I think of two people, really. Curtis Strange and Payne Stewart. Curtis, for his grinding tenacity. To me, he's the ultimate U.S. Open player. And Payne, for all that his 99 win at Pinehurst has come to mean. The definitive book on Payne Stewart came out in 2019 from Kevin Robbins. It's called The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, and we will revisit our interview from that time. First up, though, from Team Sharpstein at the U.S. Open, Charlotte 49ers head men's golf coach Ryan Cabbage. So, Ryan, my first question is, I guess I didn't realize that you were going out there for the U.S. Open. Did you make that decision as soon as our man qualified?
Yeah, it was actually, I was watching the live scoring when Matt was in Dallas. And just after those final scores posted, I got a call from Matt, and he said, Coach, I'm in, and I would love for you to be out there with me. I said, absolutely, I'll be there. Just tell me when. And 24 hours later, flights were booked, hotel was booked, and here we are.
Oh, this is so great. Now, you were an accomplished player as an amateur. You played golf at Auburn, I think famously roomed with Jason Duffner. Did you ever try to qualify for the U.S. Open? Did you ever qualify for it?
I never did. I think as most college players do and most amateurs, I think we all give it a shot, but I never was good enough and fortunate enough to have qualified. And I'll tell you, after seeing this golf course out here this week in this rough, it's probably a good thing that I didn't qualify for the U.S. Open.
Yeah, we'll get to that here in a second. Ryan Cabbage, head coach of the Charlotte 49ers, is our guest taking dead aim. Although he's in sort of a different position this week, he's Matt Sharpstein's coach in college. We talked with Matt a week or so ago. Matt and his dad out there for the U.S. Open. In a way, the kids, when they're at school, the parents sort of entrust them to you. You, in a way, are their surrogate fathers. You're actually out there with his father. What exactly is your role this week?
You know, primarily for me this week, we've discussed a lot of the golf course. I'm sort of assistant to the caddy, I think would probably be the best way to describe it. But just talking through shots and different lines off the tee and hole locations and where balls need to be left and so on and so forth. And then from there, I guess maybe player manager, I guess for lack of a better term, on that. Just trying to take a little bit of the off the golf course stuff off of Matt's plate. Whether it be tickets or whether arranging practice rounds or whatever it might be. So just trying to help any way that I can and just do whatever I can do to try to help Matt to be successful.
So when did Team Sharpstein get out to Torrey Pines?
So they flew out. They got out here, I guess that was on Friday, and were able to get out on the golf course on Saturday. And then I flew in on Sunday, and I was out to Torrey by 1 o'clock that afternoon. And we were able. He played 9 holes on Saturday. We played, I guess, probably about 10 or 12 holes. He kind of bounced around a little bit on Sunday. nine holes yesterday, going out for 18 today, and then Wednesday will be a little bit of a rest day and nine holes, and then get ready for Thursday.
Now, has there been a moment where, and I imagine it was early on, if at all, I don't care how accomplished you are as an amateur, and obviously Matt Sharpstein is quite accomplished if he's a medalist at a sectional for the U.S. Open and qualifies for the U.S. Open, but there still has to be that moment when you actually arrive at the venue and you look around and you're wide-eyed. You can't. It's almost a surreal experience that you can't believe you're actually here. What was the moment when he went from that to someone sort of snapping a finger in front of his face saying, hey, man, you're competing in this thing. Let's quit being wide-eyed and glad we're here, and let's get down to business.
Yeah, I think initially everyone's going to be a little bit starstruck. You know, they know in the back of their mind this is what they want to do long-term. They want to be out here with these guys every week. But at the same time, when it is your first time and it's a major championship, and you walk out on that range, and there's Brooks, and there's Bryson, and so on and so forth, and the guys that you see every week out here, you know, you are a little bit starstruck. I think playing nine holes with Webb Simpson on Monday afternoon, I think that helped a little bit. But Matt's done a nice job, and his dad's done a nice job of really trying to map out the golf course and trying to, again, like we talked about before, figure out a way to be successful and to come out here and compete. So I think he's in a pretty good spot with that. But, you know, it is interesting when you step out on the range this morning and you hit balls next to Bryson DeChambeau. You know, it's hard not to get a little bit starstruck when you're doing that. But overall, he's done a nice job with it this week.
How welcoming are the pros of amateurs like Matt in the situation of the U.S. Open?
They've been the guys that he spent some time with this week have been fantastic. I think they all have an understanding, because the reality of it is they were one time where Matt is.
Right.
They were the amateur, and maybe they didn't qualify for a U.S. Open. Maybe they did. But I think they all have that appreciation of, number one, here is a supreme talent as an amateur to be able to qualify for the U.S. Open. So I think there's a respect level there. And then that appreciation, I think, has helped them to be very welcoming. And then, like I said, playing with Webb, he was fantastic. Matt played with Lonto Griffin, played the back nine on Tuesday morning with Lonto, and he was fantastic as well. And it's neat to see those guys sort of take a young amateur sort of under their wing. Can they talk about certain shots, and they talk about hole locations. They talk about making sure that you are not wearing yourself out, because that's the easiest thing. The amateurs get here, and they want to spend all day, every day at the golf course, and you're playing Torrey Pines and so on and so forth. Those little reminders of, hey, look, don't kill yourself. Make sure come Thursday you're rested mentally and physically, because obviously it's the U.S. Open, and it's going to wear you down Thursday through Sunday.
Yeah, I guess you sort of answered my next question beyond welcoming, you know, sharing of information. Someone like Webb Simpson, who, oh, yeah, by the way, he's got one of these trophies at the house as a U.S. Open champ. How willing they are to share of information or to give advice on, hey, when you get to this hole, look for this angle over here and whatnot. Everybody's really cool with that?
Oh, yes, they've been fantastic. You know, the biggest thing, even those guys that play out on tour every week, this is just a different kind of deal when it's a U.S. Open championship, and even some of this rough and things around the greens, even these guys don't see on a regular basis. But all of the guys have been terrific with pointing out certain things, and especially around the greens, hole locations. If you happen to drive it in the rough, here's your play up to this hole location, leave yourself this pitch, a lot of those kind of things. But the guys have been fantastic and very welcoming to Matt, for sure.
Charlotte 49ers head coach Ryan Cabbage is our guest taking Dead Aim. He's out at Torrey Pines. He is the caddy's coach, as we will, for Team Sharpstein. His boy Matt Sharpstein is competing in the U.S. Open this week. Let's talk a little bit about this golf course. It is, for lack of a better term, it's a monster. I think if they want to, they can stretch this thing out to nearly 78 or just over 7,800 yards. You've already mentioned that the rough is long. Is it thick? Is it lush? Is this one of these U.S. Opens that we're going to go, oh, my God, when a ball disappears?
It's a little bit spotty off the fairways. You certainly can get what I would call typical – U.S. Open rough lies. But at the same time, there are some places off the fairways where you can get a little bit fortunate and still be able to play somewhat normal golf shot at that point. It's not going to be a 56-degree wedge back out to the fairway every time you drive it into the rough, so it is more playable. It is pretty thick around the greens, I will say that, and that's something that, even seeing some of the tour guys and some really good players, top-ranked players in the world, still trying to figure that out early in the week on how to handle some of these shots around the greens. They did trim the rough on Monday afternoon, but it, as Matt and I were talking about as we were going around the back nine, they pretty much just topped it off a little bit. They didn't really cut much of the length out of it. So I think the biggest challenge with the rough is around the greens. And then there is rough off the fairways, but it's a little bit spotty. So you can get a little bit fortunate in some places and still be able to play. The difficulty, regardless of where you are, even the lighter rough off the edges of the fairway, is holding these greens because they're going to continue to get firmer and get faster as we go through the week. And I think that's going to be the biggest transition with the golf course as you move from Tuesday through Sunday afternoon.
Another thing that I'm curious about is the greens themselves. This is Southern California. This is Poana. Matt's from our neck of the woods over here. He don't see much Poana. What has been the adjustment putting? And I'm sure playing at different times of the day. Of course, later in the day, the Po starts to bud, and that's a whole different ball game. What has been the adjustment putting? What are his thoughts on putting on Po?
He was fortunate to have played on Poana out at Bandon Dunes at the U.S. Amateur last year. They're a little bit different than what he experienced at Bandon. He's played a couple of his practice rounds in the afternoon, and I didn't notice, and he didn't really mention anything about them getting bumpy or anything like that later in the day. I think that's kind of – Poana is kind of known to do that. But for the most part, they were still pretty smooth, even later in the day at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon out here, to where you didn't feel like you were – that you didn't have control over the balls rolling on the greens and things like that. So overall, other than, like I said, the speed of the greens, that'll be an adjustment that Matt will have to continue to make as we move through the week, because they're probably a foot and a half faster on Tuesday than they were on Monday. And we all know the USGA, it's going to continue to move in that direction with firmer and faster as we go through the week.
Is it a golf course? I realize Matt hits it a good ways, but is it a golf course that at times can be overwhelming in terms of its length for someone, or is the length of the golf course not going to be that big an issue for Matt?
It's going to be – it's a lot of long irons into par fours not very many reachable par fives. And there are a couple. I haven't paid much attention to the length of holes as far as the yardage on the signs. I know there's one at 515 that's a converted par 5 into a par 4 this week. There's another one that's going to play into the wind over on the back nine that's right at 500. It probably plays longer because of the direction of the wind. It'll play longer than number 6 because it's going to be a little bit downwind at 515. So 500 yards is probably playing closer to 530. You're going to see a lot of guys hitting, driver 3-iron, driver 4-iron out there. And Matt does hit it. He certainly hits it plenty far enough. But at the same time, you step up on 515 or 500 yards playing 530. It doesn't matter how far you hit it. you're going to wear that 4-iron out into some of these greens. And then, the important thing, regardless of the length, is just making sure that the ball stays in correct relation to the hole.
Is he scheduled to go early, late, or late early?
He's right around 8:45 on Thursday.
Good.
And then around 2, I think it's maybe 2:30 or just after on Friday afternoon.
I got to think, if it's your first U.S. Open, an early late is best. You're anticipating so much, you don't want to have to wait around till 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday, right?
For sure, and that was something that Matt had mentioned even this morning. I think he liked that draw of going early on Thursday. Most likely going to see probably the softest, most benign conditions that you could see at a U.S. Open would be on Thursday morning. So a good opportunity to get out and put a good round together, kind of get the get the nerves out of the way early, and like you said, not have to sit around and think about it too much, which Matt doesn't stress about a whole lot. So he would have been fine either way, but I think a good thing to go ahead and get on out there on Thursday morning.
All right, Coach, get you out of here on this. I know you're biased, but you got to give me an answer. Give me a percentage on the chances of our guy making the cut at the United States Open this week.
You did put me on the spot, didn't you? You know, I don't know, you know, what percentage of that I would put on it. He's driven the ball beautifully since he's gotten out here. I think that's a big key. I won't give you a percentage. I'll give you the keys for
Matt
this week. You know, if he continues to drive it the way that he has, and then on those holes, because you're going to miss fairways. I mean, these things are, you can almost touch both sides of the fairway if you're standing in the middle. But those times when he does get it in that rough, just managing his game accordingly, leave it in the spot where it leaves the simplest up and down, and then take advantage of those opportunities. If he can do that, then those percentages, I think, are going to be pretty good to be here on Saturday and Sunday.
From Team Matt Sharpstein at the United States Open at Torrey Pines, that's Charlotte 49ers head men's golf coach Ryan Cabbage. And when we return, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer takes dead aim at all the major storylines from this year's U.S. Open, presented by Neogenic Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies. And we've reached the Greater Golf Express Halfway House on the show this week. Visit the Golfer's Paradise to get prior generation TaylorMade TP5 and TP5X for $39.99 a dozen. GreaterGolfExpress.com or Centrum Plaza Pineville. There's a reason Greater Golf Express is called the golfer's paradise. They constantly beat the box stores on every level, like the Cleveland CBX2 Steel Wedge for $139.99 or the Cleveland RTX Zip Core Steel Wedge for $149.99. Need a new set of irons? Get the Tour Edge Hot Launch 4 irons. 4-through pitching wedge, sale priced at $399.99. Right hand only. And due to huge response, Greater Golf Express is continuing its ball abrasion sale. Get Titleist prior generation Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls for only $39.99 a dozen, or prior generation TaylorMade TP5 and TP5X golf balls for $39.99 a dozen. Hurry, supplies are going faster than a downhill putt. Drop by the store in Pineville or log on greatergolfexpress.com. And don't forget, Greater Golf Express will give you a better club fitting for less. They have 9 fitting carts for all the major manufacturers. Lower your scores, get fitted. You need it? The Golfer's Paradise. Greater Golf Express has it. Located in Pineville next to Home Depot or GreaterGolfExpress.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are taking Dead Aim, presented by Neogenic Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies and Greater Golf Express, the golfer's paradise. Join now from La Jolla, California, Torrey Pines, site of this week's U.S. Open, by Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Let's start with the question everyone has whenever a U.S. Open comes around. Ron, tell me about the rough at Torrey Pines.
Although they have some. They don't typically have a whole lot of it during Farmers Insurance Open in late January, but they have let it grow in, and it's been a pretty popular topic here just because of, I think inconsistency is probably the wrong word, but it's the just the way it grows. If you hit it in the right spots, you can get some good lies and make, you know, play from it, and others, you could be 2 feet off the green and wondering how you're going to get the next one on the green. It's just dense and difficult in that way. You know, it's as U.S. Opens like to be. I mean, it asks those two simple questions: can you hit the fairway and can you hit the green? And I think it's Torrey Pines South on its easiest days, it's a hard golf course. I think they've got it where they want it. It's firm and bouncy. I think the greens, you know, Holton Greens will be a challenge, but it's a as Rory McIlroy said, it's fair, and that's all you can ask in the U.S. Open.
Yeah, that sort of echoes. I was talking with Ryan Cabbage, the Charlotte 49ers coach, who's out there with Matt Sharpstein, and he was saying that kind of the same thing, that if you hit it in the wrong place, it's a nightmare, but it's kind of not really spotty, but there are spots out that you could advance it from. But he said that the rough around the greens is U.S. Open nasty, and that's what's really going to test those guys all week, is trying to gauge how the ball is going to come out of that stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's where you're going to see a lot of shots, you know, both saved and lost. If you get lucky and you're in a good line, you can save the shot. You probably have to count yourself fortunate, but it does not take much to bounce, to bounce away just a little bit. And you're just down there, you know, I forget now, one of the players said, you know, I put two balls down. They were a couple feet apart. One of them was fine. The other one, I moved 6 inches. So I just think, you know, luck is part of the game, and I think if you know, you just, the key is minimizing the moments when you have to rely on luck to get you where you need to be. I mean, it's, you know, the U.S. Open, I mean, it's sort of like golf's version of a porcupine, you know. I mean, you just it's going to stick you at some point, and you just have to understand that and move on from it.
Rob Krejcik with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Before we get to the big stories from people who are there, I want to talk about a big story from someone who's not there. Really, two things. First and foremost, I love plaques on golf courses. Anytime I'm playing somewhere and there's a historical plaque, I love to read it, love to get my picture made next to it, love to try whatever shot it's commemorating. I love that. I saw that there is a plaque now commemorating Tiger's birdie on the 18th, the 72nd hole in the 08 Open. They got him in the playoff with Rocco Mediate. That ceremony, I think, was yesterday or day before yesterday. Where is that plaque going to be placed?
I know they had the ceremony. I don't know specifically. I know it won't be right on the actual spot where he hit the putt from, because that would get into play there a little bit. But I think around the 18th hole, because, yeah, it's you know, one of the most famous moments in U.S. Open history. When I was out here for media day, they put the hole in that spot and then had everybody go over and sort of, you know, they had a little tee over here. Here's where Tiger was. Now you hit the putt. They were taping it, trying to get people who made it to give the reaction to it, you know, just like Tiger did and all that. Fortunately, I never scared the hole, so I could just sort of nonchalantly walk over and pick my ball up and not act out there. But, yeah, I mean, it's the kind of shot that deserves that recognition. I mean, if there is a void in this U.S. Open, it's the Tiger's not here, because, I mean, it was 13 years ago. We all know the story and all that. And sadly, we also know where he is now, although I guess we saw some video of him this week in Los Angeles putting a little weight on that leg with his crutches and all that. But, you know, it's not quite the same without him.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. If you'd have told me 4 months ago, knowing the depth of the injury that he sustained, that we would be seeing him in crutches and a compression sleeve and even putting any weight on his foot, and I'm not talking about him ever playing golf again, just being mobile again, I'd have taken it. And I thought the video was in some ways amazing once again as to this guy's powers of recovery.
Well, yeah, I think it also reinforces what's it been 4 or 5 months, that after all that time, look where he still is.
Yeah.
Again, because nobody knows the details, don't know, you know, any sign of him making progress is a good sign. Yeah, the golf thing, just sort of, you put that away and pack it away until another day, if that day ever comes. But, you know, it just is a reminder of all that he's going through, and, you know, the few comments he's made that it was the most painful thing he's ever had to go through, and still going through it, it just reinforces just, you know, how lucky in a lot of ways he is just to still be here.
Ron Green Jr. is with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. He's at Torrey Pines for the U.S. Open. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. I realize in some respects, quote unquote, it's good for the game and the growth of the game and the PIP program and all that. But is everyone about as tired of the whole DeChambeau Koepka thing as I am, or am I just in the minority?
No, I think you're in the vast majority. I think it's time to let it go. I mean, you know, there was all the things, they're going to be paired together and all this stuff. You know, what were they, even if they were, what were they going to do? Were they going to arm wrestle on the first tee? You know, they would have nodded and gone on and played, and, you know, Brooks said, you know, I don't care who I play with, I just stay in my bubble. And that is what you sort of do. I mean, that's what. There's so much else to worry about when you're playing a U.S. Open. Now, maybe it transpires that they end up together somehow down the line, and we'll see. But I think it was it was a diversion. I mean, it was different for golf a little bit. I think, you know, it's interesting how it all popped up after the player impact program sort of gets revealed, and there's all that out there and sort of generating more, you know, I don't know that they're judging positive and negative publicity in their algorithms, but I think obviously they got a lot of attention to it. And I think, you know, I think the USGA did the right thing by not putting them together to start. I mean, granted, they separated them by a half a day with their tee times. But yeah, I mean, it's been a, you know, a subject players are talking about, players are paying attention to it. And, but you know, it ultimately goes back to the golf, and we'll see where all that takes us.
Speaking of the golf, we forget Bryson DeChambeau is the defending United States Open champion. If you'd have told me that he was going to do to Wingfoot what he did last year, I'd have said you were crazy. Now, if you'd have told me that he was going to play that same way and be successful at Torrey Pines, that makes more sense to me. Does it to you as well?
Well, he's going to try it. I think, I mean, it worked last year, and it worked at a place where we didn't think it could. I think, even as strong as he is, if you get it in the wrong spots in this rough, you're going to have some challenges. And he talked about that it's a little different. But, yeah, he, you know, I think the attention is sort of focused elsewhere until we get right here to it, away from him. Because, I mean, you know, there's all the Phil Mickelson talk. And, you know, I read the story that more money has been bet on Phil for this tournament than on all the other players combined.
That's crazy.
Which makes me think I wish I were a bookie, because
yes.
I think they're gonna pull a lot of it in pretty soon. I mean, I hope I'm in a lot of ways. I hope I'm wrong, because if he could be back in contention and maybe do the unthinkable again, I mean, good grief, what a story that'd be. But I just think that's a little that might be a little hopeful right now. But then again, I never imagined Kiowa happening. So, but I think if you want to take your five guys as pre-tournament, or you know, five guys to beat in this championship, I think Bryson has to be one of them, just because of the way he can play, and it's such a big, long golf course, and it's, you know, essentially at sea level, although I guess you're like 20 floors above the ocean, as somebody who walked down, not me, but as somebody walked down the path to the ocean found out when they realized they had to climb it back up. You know, it the air plays heavy, and the ball doesn't go quite as far. Now, it still goes a long way, but I think Bryson fully expects he will be right there, you know, in the mix at the end.
I guess until he wins one, I'm going to hear John Rahm's name mentioned as the favorite or one of the favorites at every major championship. My pushback on this would be, I don't know how what happened at the Memorial is going to affect him. There had to be a layoff time where he wasn't able to practice and got his rhythms all thrown off. So we really don't know what we're getting out of John Rahm this week, at least in my opinion. What do you think?
I think if you gave me one player to pick, he would be my pick. I just think, yeah, the Memorial, he was out for 7 days, I guess he said. He didn't play any golf, couldn't practice. Now, he has a simulator in his house. He was able to go down there and use that, he said, but you can't chip and you can't putt. And he goes, after a while, you're just sort of hitting shots, and it's not the same thing. But he started back, I guess, last Saturday, and he sounded like a guy who felt like he could get back what he had pretty quickly. I mean, he only won here. That was his first win on the PGA Tour, what was it, 4 years ago. He loves this place. He and his wife come to San Diego about once a month just to spend time here. He's a member of a club near here and just really, really likes it. I mean, to the point he proposed to his wife literally just down the hill from here at Torrey Pines State Park where they were hiking. And so it's got that special meaning to him. And I just think, you know, he just looks to me like a guy built and designed to win major championships. And I just think I just had the feeling, like, given what happened at Memorial, and as he said, I should have gotten vaccinated earlier. I just didn't. How about the turnaround that 2 weeks later he comes out and wins the U.S. Open? I don't know. Maybe that's just the story creator in me trying to imagine. Wouldn't that have a nice book into it? And, you know, maybe he goes out and shoots 80 and none of that happens. And but I like his chance.
Ron Green Jr. is with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Our guest taking dead aim. He's out at Torrey Pines for the U.S. Open. First off, I don't know how much you saw of it last week, but I loved seeing Congaree on television. And I hope somehow the PGA Tour finds its way back to Congaree. But one thing else that I liked seeing was DJ being DJ again outside of a huge hiccup on the 16th. 17th hole on Sunday. He could have won that tournament. How does he feel coming into this week at Torrey Pines?
I think if you can be under the radar as the number one player in the world, I think he is that way. I think the attention has been focused on other people. You know, I mean, like I said, there's Phil, there's Brooks, there's Bryce, and there's Rahm. You know, you wonder, all right, Rory won a month ago at Quail Hollow. You know, can he fix what was wrong at Kiowa? There's all these other stories. And, he's Dustin Johnson, and yet there were signs. You know, Congaree, I kept waiting for him to, like, go ahead and finish it off. He's going to go win. We're going to come show up at Torrey Pines. Like, all the questions about what's going on with Dustin Johnson will have been answered. They haven't fully been answered, but, there was a spark there again. There was a reason to reconsider him, and not that you would forget the number one player in the world, but he's missed the cut in both major championships this year. So he's a guy who seemed to have all the answers for so long, and now there's some sort of questions because he's just done so little. But I wouldn't surprise me if he is back to being Dustin Johnson.
Ron, I know you probably don't write about them as much, but I remember in 2015, one of the things I enjoyed during the practice rounds was seeing all the qualifiers who had made the U.S. Open and watching them on their practice rounds and watching them wide-eyed on the driving ranges. They're sitting there hitting balls right next to the best players in the world. Is that something that every time you go to a U.S. Open, you enjoy seeing as well?
Yeah, well, you look through the tee sheet and you realize there's a lot of names you don't know. And then you remember that's by design. In some ways, the most egalitarian tournament there is. You can play your way in. That is, if you have a certain handicap index that allows you to try to qualify. But it's, and hopefully the better part is that somebody you've basically never heard of or who's played their way in suddenly becomes a factor in the tournament. Maybe it's only a day, maybe it's 2 days. They become, a thread in the fabric of this championship. And that's what the USGA wants. That sort of underpins this whole thing, that's the from many one slogan that they've adopted. And it's one of the, I don't know if you call anything charming about the U.S. Open, but that's one of its charms.
Get you out of here on this. We've talked about pretty much every major player. Who's the one player we haven't talked about that you're not going to be at all surprised if we're talking about them come Saturday and Sunday?
Xander Schauffele. I mean, hometown guy. I guess he's now moved over to Las Vegas, but he's sixth in the world, and he shows up on major championship leaderboards. I mean, he's always around there. I mean, he's in some ways he's like one of those television commercials you just see over and over again. And I think Schauffele is the kind of guy who he's been here and practiced some on the golf course when they had it closed, and he's just good. He's steady. And he has enough experience. Now, he has to take the experience he's had in majors where he's gotten there and been right around it and then sort of, gone backward a little bit at the end. Now, the last step is the biggest leap to take. But I think he's a guy who Sunday night, if he's the guy we end up talking about, it would not be a huge surprise.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's our boots on the ground at this year's U.S. Open, Ron Green Jr. And up next, we turn our attention to what I think would make a great Father's Day gift. The book is about one of the great U.S. Open champions of all time. Kevin Robbins takes dead aim at his last stand of Payne Stewart, presented by Neogenic Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies. First, though, one last stop at the Greater Golf Express Halfway House, where you can get prior generation Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X for $39.99 a dozen. Greater Golf Express.com or Centrum Plaza Pineville. There's a reason Greater Golf Express is called the golfer's paradise. They constantly beat the box stores on every level, like the Cleveland CBX2 Steel Wedge for $139.99 or the Cleveland RTX Zip Core Steel Wedge for $149.99. Need a new set of irons? Get the Tour Edge Hot Launch 4 irons. 4-through pitching wedge, sale priced at $399.99, right hand only. And due to huge response, Greater Golf Express is continuing its ball abrasion sale. Get Titleist Prior Generation Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls for only $39.99 a dozen, or prior generation TaylorMade TP5 and TP5X golf balls for $39.99 a dozen. Hurry, supplies are going faster than a downhill putt. Drop by the store in Pineville or log on greatergolfexpress.com. And don't forget, Greater Golf Express will give you a better club fitting for less. They have 9 fitting carts for all the major manufacturers. Lower your scores, get fitted. You need it? The golfer's paradise. Greater Golf Express has it. Located in Pineville next to Home Depot or greatergolfexpress.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Neogenic Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies and Greater Golf Express. This interview was conducted 2 years ago upon the release of the book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. It coincided with the 20th anniversary of his tragic plane crash, and to me is the definitive work about Payne. The author is Kevin Robbins, and Kevin, first off, what was the impetus for writing this story so many years after Payne's passing?
I wasn't really looking hard for another book idea, Charlie, but I was in front of my computer. It was a Saturday night in November of, 2016, I think. And I just accidentally came across the final National Transportation Safety Board report of the flight and of October 25th, 1999, the one carrying Payne Stewart and five other people, including two pilots. And you know, as government reports are, it was very detailed. There was not a story there, but there sure was a story to be told from this document, I thought. And the document had been released in its final form in 2005, so it came after the initial journalism about the death of Payne Stewart. It came out after Payne's wife, Tracy, had written the authorized biography. So I wondered if there were new ground to cover. There was lots. And also, I'm from Kansas City. I grew up in Missouri. Payne Stewart was someone I kept an eye on, and being from my home state. And so that's really how it started. And it started as a book about the flight of October 25, 1999. I should be transparent here. My agent quickly determined that wasn't a good book topic. It was a good magazine story, maybe, but not a book topic. So I just started looking deeper, and I looked backward, and I thought about that season, and it was really such a good season in golf. The major championships were historic, each in its own way. And so that's how it began, and here we are.
The book is entitled The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, and that title takes on many different meanings when you read the book. It was his last year on tour, the last year of his career. It was the last moments of his life, that flight. There was the Ryder Cup concession to Colin Montgomery, sort of the last stand of golf congeniality in that. And then there was the last stand of his particular style of golf. And you go into detail about that, him and the Hal Suttons and the Azingers. This was 1999 as we were, you know, sort of segueing from the wound ball to the solid core ball, and the guys who played by feel, Corey Pavins in that group too, as opposed to the guys who began to overpower golf courses, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, etc. When did the title come to you, and when it did, was it after you had already considered all of these different things, or did it just sort of happen to fit that narrative?
It came rather late, actually. I think I was probably midway through the story, and it was untitled. I was thinking about a season narrative, a story of a season, and it's not so much that Payne was staging a stand, really. In other words, I don't see him as an aggressor. I see him almost as a defendant, and he was resisting this wave of he and his peers of that generation, and I would define that as players born before 1960. He was defending the game against this wave that was powerful and inevitable and unrestrainable, and it was personified by a 23-year-old Tiger Woods, and behind him, with him, 29-year-old Phil Mickelson and 19-year-old Sergio Garcia. These are all feel players too. I want to be clear about that. They have their own sense of feel. But my point in making this part of Payne's story is that Payne Stewart and Sutton and O'Meara and Tom Lehman, Ben Crenshaw, Corey Pavin, as you mentioned, they learned golf with hard equipment to play: steel shafts, forged iron heads, persimmon woods. wound balls. The next generation, the younger guys, they learned with the equipment that made golf an easier game to play and that makes possible the golf that we see now on our televisions every weekend when Brooks Koepka hits a 3-wood 350 yards and Dustin Johnson plays par fives with wedges. So that's my point. I think there are both kinds of field players, but the field player in Payne Stewart and his generation, they had to learn a different kind of field to move the ball around accurately with the equipment they learned with.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. As you look back on Payne Stewart's life, he was a much more complex individual than I remembered. And as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, you know, may we all benefit from the gift of history as Payne Stewart has. We all remember the guy winning the U.S. Open, kicking his fist and his foot in the air, and then immediately embracing Phil Mickelson and telling him, you know, none of this matters. You're going to be a father, and that's what matters. We remember the concession to Colin Montgomery. We remember him sort of segueing into the position of golf's statesman of what's right and wrong in the game. We forget, this is a guy who was capable of immature and often boorish behavior, even in the process of winning major championships, in addition to being a guy who was capable of donating his entire paycheck for winning a tournament to a children's hospital. Is it fair? I guess that may not be the word, but when you're looking back on a life, should we concentrate on where he ended up more than where he came from? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and yes, I think you do. I think that's the way you judge all people is how they were in the end. We're all evolving all the time. We're all moving in one direction, sometimes imperceptibly, but you know, we're either getting better or getting worse. And we're either improving or we're not. And Payne was, demonstrably. He showed people in 1999 through his actions and his words, but mainly through his actions, that he had grown up. So, yeah, look, Payne as a young man, he ran hot. He didn't know how to manage his emotions, which is something that most elite athletes learn to do, not all, but most. And that's how they achieve greatness. And Payne achieved greatness despite that. He still was an emotional man, I believe, in 1999. But he had learned to control and manage and mitigate the emotions that had gotten him into trouble as a young man. And so, but back to your point, yeah, I think we judge somebody by who they were in the end. We have to consider their entire body of work, their entire lives. And that also is, to my mind, what makes Payne more admirable in 99 is where he had been.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. When I was talking with some friends last weekend after a golf round about your book and about the conversation we would be having, this phrase, this term came up, and please don't think I'm intending it to have the same worldwide impact, but this was, for a lot of us, especially golf fans, this was a sports JFK moment. By that I mean everyone who was alive in 63 knows where they were when they heard the news that the president had been assassinated. For my generation, there are two. There was the Challenger explosion in 84. There was, of course, 9/11. I remember exactly where I was for both things. And as we were discussing this in a sports world, all of us remembered where we were or what we were doing that fall morning in 1999 when we heard about Payne Stewart's aircraft. Do you think that's a fair comparison to make?
Well, I wouldn't compare it in scale or scope to 9/11.
Oh, no, no, no. That's what I'm saying. Don't take it the wrong way. But just in terms of people remembering where they were when they heard the news.
Yes, that's true. Everybody I've ever talked with about this book, from the people I interviewed to friends, you know, students of mine, whose parents have talked to about it. Yes, they do. And I do wonder why that is. I think the first reason is it was so unusual and it was so mysterious. And I remember I was a reporter in St. Louis at the Post-Dispatch. We were gathered around a TV in the South County Bureau watching this thing unfold. And it went on for so long, Charlie. It was like 3 hours of televised uncertainty. And there was a plane, a Learjet 35 carrying a famous athlete, no response from inside the cockpit, and no one knew how it would end. Was this plane going to fly forever? Was it going to crash in Des Moines? Anything? It seemed like one of those days where anything was possible. And just the intrigue of it all, and the building sense of doom. This clearly was not going to end well. And no one at that time, in the moment, knew if anybody was alive on the plane. It turns out they were not. They had perished pretty early in the flight from a lack of oxygen. And by the time they hit the Florida-Alabama line, they were dead. But nobody knew that at the time. And so, yes, we remember that with great clarity because it was jolting.
The book opens with. And I read it twice because it was so stunning. Most of the time, I skip over prologues of books. I just say, whatever that is, I don't care. I'm moving to chapter one. Do not skip the prologue of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. It is a riveting account of that flight and of what, since none of us will ever really know what happened, it is as riveting an account of what probably happened as you will ever read. As I was reading it, I was wondering who all were you able to talk to? Did you speak to the fighter pilots that were dispatched? Who did you talk to air traffic controllers who were on duty at the time? Or did you just get that strictly from the National Transportation Safety Bureau report?
All of it came from the report.
Wow.
I just coughed. There was no need to talk to those people who had this very incidental and temporary involvement in that day. Plumbing their memories 20 years later probably wasn't going to produce anything beyond what was in. And this is how detailed that report was. Entire transcript of communications to the plane, from the plane, all air traffic control communication to outbound and inbound airline pilots who were nearby in the airspace, all radio transmissions between the military pilots and their commanders on the ground. That kind of in-the-moment, authentic primary source conversation really made that, I think, that section just terribly dramatic. It was kind of hard to pull back on some. I mean, there was more detail that I thought bordered on the gratuitous, but it was really hard to know where that line was.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim. We mentioned the fact that in his early in his career and really even when he started winning major championships, Payne could be quite a pistol at times and didn't make the best decisions from a behavior standpoint. There was a moment in his life, and I got to thinking about this as I was reading your book, that in a way mirrors Tiger Woods. Follow me on this. For better or for worse, Earl Woods was sort of Tiger Woods' true north. He was his moral compass, not in his own actions, but in his words. He was a do as I say, not as I do kind of guy. And you can point to the unraveling of Tiger's personal life almost to the day that Earl Woods passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Bill Stewart was the guiding force in Payne Stewart's life, his true north. And he passed away before Payne realized the great success of his professional career. And I just wonder, as I was reading your book, I was wondering if he would have lived, do you think that there would have been someone to pull Payne back and say, boy, what are you doing? Stop this.
That's a really, really good question. So I never knew Payne Stewart, and I never knew Bill Stewart. Now, I did visit with Payne's sisters for quite a long time on a couple of occasions, including a personal visit to Springfield, Missouri. And we got in the car and went all over town to see the different places that Payne had been a part of. I think that Bill Stewart probably was more level and perhaps a better role model than Earl Woods. I try to be really careful in speculating. It's not what I'm.
No, that's probably knowing what we know. That's probably a safe speculation.
Yeah. And but you know, Bill Stewart was a big presence too, and a big personality. He was a salesman. He's the one who suggested to Payne that he adopt some kind of look in terms of his wardrobe in order to be better remembered, to have a style, you know, have a brand. But I do. I guess I would get the sense that Bill Stewart was a more sensible, level-headed, self-aware person who might have might have pulled his son aside and said a few words. That's really hard to say. It's a fascinating question, though.
Kevin, Tracy Stewart wrote a book. I was talking with someone the other day. You know, it's weird how it's been 20 years. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us, these people are frozen in time.
Yep.
Aaron Stewart's a grown man who's about to become a tournament director for an LPGA event. And when I was told that, my first reaction was, what do you mean he's 10? You know, to me, he'll always be that little boy who was there at the service. Tracy wrote a book. Did you have any contact with the family? Did you get the blessing from the family? Has there been any contact with Chelsea, Aaron, or Tracy on this book?
Yes. I did get Tracy's blessing to proceed. I thought that was important. I figured probably rightly that the people closest to Payne Stewart would be reluctant to talk with me if Tracy were unaware of the book or didn't approve of the project in the beginning. With that blessing, Tracy told me that through a letter that she didn't want to do any more interviews. I was fine with that because I wrote this book about what was happening in 99, and anything that really happened in the future, I didn't include. So there's no one looking back and reflecting on anything that happened in 99 or what Payne meant to the world of golf or anything like that. It's a very in-the-moment kind of story. And for that reason also, I didn't need to talk to Tracy or to Chelsea and Aaron. They were 10 and 12 at the time. Their memories of that day, while I'm sure they remember some things, and those would be very painful to recount, their presence in the story didn't require me to do an interview with them, if that makes sense.
No, well, fair enough.
I wanted to talk with people who were present and part of it in 99. And most of the book, as you know, takes place on the golf course or between tournaments or something like that. October 25th, 99, takes up some pages in the book, as do the following 4 days. And the book's over on that Sunday after Tiger Woods wins the tour championship. That's the end of the story. So the bulk of the interviews I did were with people like players, his caddy, Mike Hicks, his coach, Chuck Cook, his friends back in Dallas, who were present and had a part in Payne's life in 1999. So Tracy and I did speak. She did read the manuscript even before copy editing. She corrected some errors, which I'm grateful for that. And her overall, I feel like I can paraphrase her overall impression of the book, that she thought that I used too many negative media portrayals of Payne. And that's fair. You know, like I think to myself, if this story were about my spouse, I probably would be disappointed too. And as the writer of this book, I probably would have been in more peril and more trouble if Tracy Stewart had loved the story, because then I wouldn't be beholden to the truth. I'd be doing another authorized biography.
Get you out of here on this. Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim, a person who is, to me, a prominent, if it's possible to be a prominent person in the background, he is, and he's mentioned several times in the book. He was a big presence at the Ryder Cup, and I'm speaking of Hal Sutton, and because of the proximity of their names alphabetically, Stewart and Sutton, they many times were lockered right next to each other, week in, week out on the PGA Tour, and as such, there was a relationship between those two guys. The last time we spoke, you had just written a brilliant piece on Hal Sutton, I believe, for Golf Digest. And we spoke at that time. I'm sure you had more than one conversation with Hal Sutton about Payne Stewart, or maybe you didn't. It struck me that Hal Sutton's the kind of guy who, once he had spoken on the subject, he had spoken on it. We weren't going to talk about it anymore. And he's sort of like the last John Wayne left in this town. And he got up and rode off. Did Hal have anything to say, or did he sort of look at you and say, Kevin, I love you, but everything I've said is on the record somewhere else?
No, we did speak. Hal Sutton is a very eloquent storyteller. And in one of the interviews that we did for this book, he started remembering that Saturday night at the Ryder Cup. And that is a story that has been told from a lot of different points of view over the years. It was the team meeting after Ben Crenshaw wagged his finger at the press conference and said something about fate. The American team was down 10-6, looked insurmountable for a single Sunday. And but they needed something. They needed something to hold on to. And so Saturday night, they went around the room, each player, and talked about why that moment was important to them. They couldn't talk about the golf. The golf seemed so beside the point. And Hal told me this story about breaking down walls. And he described how on the PGA Tour, because it's an individual sport, players don't really reveal much in a soul way to their peers, because there's this, it really is quite irrational, but there's this idea that if I tell you who I really am, you're somehow going to use that against me on the golf course. If I tell you my secrets, you're going to reveal them on the golf course. It's a strange, strange thing, but I get it. And that night, those walls came down. And my sense of the story is that, yeah, Hal and Payne knew each other because of the proximity of their lockers, but not until that Saturday night did they really know each other. And they stayed up late. They were the last two guys standing. And they decided, well, they were going to do this together and that. They were going to go fishing, and Hal was going to teach Payne how to ride a horse. And when they became Ryder Cup captains, the other would be the vice captain. They made plans. They had dreams. And a month later, Payne got on the plane.
Again, it's a great Father's Day gift, the book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, the author, Kevin Robbins. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and Charlotte 49ers head men's golf coach Ryan Cabbage, who's out at the U.S. Open with his player Matt Sharpstein, for their time and insight this week. And good luck to Matt and his dad, Jeff, for sure. A reminder to follow us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim and give us a like. Posted there now are links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the world of golf. And before we get out of here, I just want to take a second to remind you once again that this is Father's Day weekend. For so many of us, Dad introduced us to this crazy game, and there's not a time when I'm out there that I don't wish he was right there with me. If you're lucky enough, like me, to still have your dad, don't forget to give him a call. Better yet, if you're able to go see the old man do it, promise it'll make his day. And if your father's now gone to be with the Father, take a second to look up and smile. Weather-wise, may be hot, but it doesn't get much better for letting this game haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground this weekend, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. Enjoy the U.S. Open. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Neogenic Stem Cell and Regenerative Therapies, where all you have to lose is pain. And Greater Golf Express, the golfer's paradise, where you can get prior generation Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls for $39.99 a dozen. There's a reason Greater Golf Express is called the golfer's paradise. They constantly beat the box stores on every level, like the Cleveland CBX2 steel wedge for $139.99 or the Cleveland RTX Zip Core steel wedge for $149.99. Need a new set of irons? Get the Tour Edge Hot Launch 4 irons. 4 through pitching wedge, sale priced at $399.99, right hand only. And due to huge response, Greater Golf Express is continuing its ball-abration sale. Get Titleist prior generation Pro V1 and Pro V1X golf balls for only $39.99 a dozen, or prior generation TaylorMade TP5 and TP5X golf balls for $39.99 a dozen. Hurry, supplies are going faster than a downhill putt. Drop by the store in Pineville or log on greatergolfexpress.com. And don't forget, Greater Golf Express will give you a better club fitting for less. They have 9 fitting carts for all the major manufacturers. Lower your scores, get fitted. You need it? The golfer's paradise. Greater Golf Express has it. Located in Pineville next to Home Depot, or greatergolfexpress.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.